You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of October, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, Panama's president calls off the sale of public land in Colón after clashes between residents and security forces. We visit One Young World, a summit dedicated to social entrepreneurs who want to make the world a better place.
This is a unique generation. They're the most knowledgeable generation of young people that's ever existed. They're the most responsible generation of young people. But I think most importantly, they're the most powerful generation of young people.
We'll find out why getting on your bicycle can lead to heightened enlightenment. And we'll hear what's making waves in the German music market. Here's a taster. All that plus lots more over the next hour right here on Midori House. But first, let's get the news right now with Jonathan Wheatley.
Israeli leaders have today said that the nation was prepared to take action to end a stream of rockets fired in the south of the country. Palestinian militants have fired dozens of rockets into Israel from Gaza in recent days. In response, the Israeli military has fired back and killed at least four Hamas militants in the past 24 hours. Well, the Defense Minister Ehud Barak, who toured the border area, said the army was prepared for any necessary action.
Hamas and the Islamic Jihad suffered major blows in the recent weeks, and they are trying to respond. We have a courageous civilian population with standing power, standing against this threat, and the IDF is acting day and night in order to make sure that those who are trying to hurt our people will not get away with it.
Opposition activists and Syrian state media have today blamed each other for the killing of at least 25 people in the town of Douma near Damascus. Elsewhere, five people from one family, including a child and a woman, were killed in airstrikes on Marat al-Duman, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Meanwhile, more than 200 Syrian prisoners have been released by the government under a general amnesty ahead of the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha, but those accused of terrorist acts remain behind bars. Former Société Générale trader Jérôme Kerviel has been handed a three-year prison sentence for his role in France's biggest rogue trading scandal, which ultimately cost his employer nearly 5 billion euros. Reuters journalist Lionel Laurent was in the courtroom as the verdict was read out.
Jérôme Kerviel stood up to hear the verdict. He looked very nervous, he was biting his nails, and he was told by a judge that he would be spending 3 years behind bars and would have to repay 4.9 billion euros to Société Générale.
Pope Benedict has today named six new cardinals, including two from countries with large Muslim populations. All six are under 80 years old and thus eligible under church law to enter a conclave that will one day choose Benedict's successor. Among them is the American Archbishop James Michael Harvey, who was the boss of the Pope's former butler Paolo Gabriele, who was convicted this month of stealing papal documents and leaking them to the media. Here, the Prime Minister David Cameron has told the British Parliament today that the BBC has serious questions to answer about how one of its former presenters, the now deceased Jimmy Savile, was able to get away with sexual abuse for so long, adding that he didn't rule out further steps in addition to the inquiries already underway. Maria Miller is the government's culture, media and sports secretary.
These are very serious allegations, and it's absolutely right that the government reflects the deep level of public concern. What's important now is that the inquiries that are already working in looking at these allegations are able to continue to do so and get to the bottom of these problems.
And finally, accused September the 11th mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been tinting his beard red by rubbing it with fruit juice and crushed berries from his breakfast, a Pentagon spokesman has said. Mohammed first showed up for his arraignment hearing with his long, scraggly beard tinted a rusty red, and it remained dyed the same hue when he returned last week to the courtroom at the Guantanamo Bay US Naval Base in Cuba. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's 5 minutes past 1800 here in London, and you are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vas à Monocle 24.
De Londres, vous écoutez Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
位于伦敦,
From London,
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Desde Londres, esto es Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
From London,
this is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. The people of Colón, Panama, rose up in protest against the sale of their land to private interests. Now it appears they have won the fight, although lives were lost. After days of violent clashes between residents and police, the Panamanian president, Ricardo Martinelli, has announced that the sale will not go ahead. We have reached our Monocle contributor, Alexis Macharelli, in Panama. Hello.
Yes, hello.
First of all, can you tell us why the president wanted to sell some of this land in Colón?
Well, the idea behind that law that was allowing the sale of the land was to bring greater revenues to the state. The government sources say that they were hoping over the next 20 years to get maybe something like $2 billion from selling the land where the duty-free zone is installed. So that would be much better than continuing to lease the land as in the case now, which brings about $30 million every year. So basically, that was the idea, to bring in money to help the development of the area of Colón, where there's very high levels of poverty and violence.
So what did the residents of Colón have against this deal?
Well, they claim that the sale of that land would cost them jobs. This area of the duty-free zone has about 2,000 companies working there, and they employ some 30,000 people. They were fearing that if the current situation was going to end, that they could lose their jobs. They were also denouncing the fact that some of that money, despite the promises, would not go back into the development of Colón and would just help to cover the huge government spending that is currently taking place in Panama with massive construction projects of motorways, of bridges, and that the government is spending a lot of money at the moment on those.
And do you think they had a case there in their argument?
I'm sorry?
Do you think they had a case, they had a good reason to fear that they weren't going to benefit from all that revenue?
Well, you could argue that they had a good reason in the sense that those projects, just where I live, for example, in the old part of the city, the colonial part of the city, the government is building a viaduct around it, a sea viaduct, and that is costing some $700 million. And we have seen already in the last few months the bill just rising and rising because they always cost that keep being added. And to be honest, all those costs are not very clear. There's one company, a Brazilian company called Odebrecht, that is basically getting all the public contracts here in terms of constructions. And a lot of people in the opposition, human rights groups, are claiming that the business deal between the government and these companies are not very clear.
So suggestion of corruption, I guess, is in the air here.
Indeed, yeah, this is something that goes around the government of Ricardo Martinelli, although there's hardly ever any investigation done on allegations of corruption. I recently spoke to a senior banker in Panama who has worked abroad in Latin America, and he said that was his main concern, that at the moment There are a lot of people in government who have serious conflict of interest, who just don't realize anymore what's public space and what is private space, that the line is now very blurred. And there is some sort of impunity. So we have regulation that are kind of first world, if you look at the papers, but in the implementation, we are at the third world level, really. There's hardly anyone ever being investigated when there are allegations of corruption. But he also said that, you know, as long as jobs are being created in the country, and it is the case at the moment, we have a massive economic growth. Last year was over 10%. So jobs are being created, and lots of jobs. The people, you know, tend to keep quiet, despite the risk that, you know, after a while, that growth we're having now, this 10% growth, might go down to 5%, and it will feel like recession.
And of course, while part of the country is enjoying that dramatic growth, there's always the disparity between, you know, the rich and the quite severe poor, I think, in parts of Panama. And I suppose, their anger about that and passion drove them into the streets to protest against this sale. Is that right?
That's certainly one of the reasons, yeah. I mean, you see massive business being done in the Colón free trade zone. It's the second biggest in the world after Hong Kong. Very rich people making a lot of money there. But it's very often people who live in here, where I am, in the capital city, Panama. They just don't want to live in Colón, which is a very poor city, again, with high levels of violence. But even here in Panama, where we have globally in the country a GDP that is three times higher than the other countries in Central America, than Costa Rica, and Honduras, you see really massive disparities between some neighborhoods in the capital here, with those very high-rise buildings, people driving their luxury four-wheel drive, and just half a mile next to those neighborhoods, you see some very poor neighborhoods. And if you go out of the city of Panama City, of the capital, just, you know, you take a two-hour drive and you end up in villages where there's no electricity, where there's no tarmac roads, where there's hardly any schooling or health facility. And you could feel really that, you know, with children walking barefoot and mud house, that you could be just in the middle of Africa and you're only 2 hours away from a city that pretends to be the next Singapore or the next Dubai.
Wow, Alex, you paint quite a strong picture. We have to wrap up, but just quickly, is there any sense of victory or celebration at all in Colón after this decision's been overturned? And I ask that knowing at least three people lost their lives, but just quickly, I wonder if you could tell us the feeling there.
Yeah, indeed, three people lost their life, and I think it's still sort of an easy calm today. There are more protests, although that have been quiet in the streets of Colón. We have seen protests here in the capital city of Panama. People are still a bit unsure about what's going to happen, especially because President Martinelli made that announcement last night through his Twitter account. He's not in the country at the moment, so really waiting for him to come back and see how the situation settles.
Alexis, thanks very much. That was Monocle contributor Alexis Masciarelli in Panama.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of the print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals and newspapers, and talking to people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Running on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show is an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brûlé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Bill Clinton, Sir Bob Geldof, Kofi Annan, Nobel Prize winner Muhammad Yunus, and Jamie Oliver are just a few of the people who participated last weekend in One Young World, a summit dedicated to young social entrepreneurs who want to make the world a better place. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman went to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to find out what the summit was about.
1,300 participants, 183 countries represented. 4 days of rallying speeches, workshops, and activities in the greenest conference center in the world.
Welcome to One Young World.
Whether they come from businesses, governments, NGOs, or universities, all the participants here have one simple thing in common.
You're all idealists. You're all working for a cause. You're all working to make the world a better place.
And to do so, the summit's founders have decided to focus on the next generation. Most of the people gathered in Pittsburgh this weekend are under the age of 25. But they already have impressive accomplishments to their name.
I mean, the whole idea behind One Young World is to give the brilliant young people of the world a platform to effect positive change. This is a unique generation. They're the most knowledgeable generation of young people that's ever existed. They're the most responsible generation of young people because technology has given them access to all the information to know, sadly, a lot of the bad things that are going on in the world. But I think most importantly, they're the most powerful generation of young people because this is the first time where the youngest people in the world know more about the biggest revolution changing the world.
This is David Jones, co-founder of One Young World and CEO of the advertising company Avas. It's through his job that he and his colleague Kate Robertson had the idea for the summit.
We were seeing more and more research that was saying, look, people want business to be more socially responsible. They get business needs to make money. You know, people want jobs, but they think business should have a purpose beyond profit. And what we decided was, as we were going to be advising our clients and saying that, you know, we should actually practice what we preached. And so we thought, well, what our purpose beyond profit will be creating this massive global open source platform for the world's young people to drive and affect positive change.
And young people responded well. Over 400 projects have come out of One Young World to date. Alexandre Le Boucher, a 20-year-old student from France, met Aaron Schrode at the summit last year. Since then, they've worked together on a project called the School Bag, which distributes school kits designed to last a year to students displaced by the earthquake in Haiti.
The aim of the School Bag is to, you know, to support universal education. We want every child, you know, I mean, how you can read and write where we have nothing, where we have no notebook, pen, pencil. So this is the goal of the School Bag.
Le Boucher was named one of the 10 brightest young minds of the year by Google. Other successes to come out of the summit include Shukri Jassad's Global Somalia Response, which provided 85,000 people with basic nutrition for 3 months, and Parker Lyoto, who became the youngest person in history to ski to the North Pole to raise awareness about climate change. To facilitate the realization of such projects, One Young World also features speakers that inspire and guide the young participants. Bill Clinton made a brief appearance to answer a few questions, while others like Kofi Annan, Sir Bob Geldof, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus gave motivating speeches.
Be the one who made it possible. Each one of you have the capacity to do that. It's not an art-shattering thing that one has to have. Just a normal person with a little bit of attention that I want to do it. Make it happen. Imagine the world that you want to live in. Just imagine. It will happen. If you don't imagine, it will never happen.
The presence of business leaders like Anthony Jenkins, Group Chief Executive of Barclays, and Global CEO of Unilever, Paul Polman, was especially important, explained co-founder David Jones, who believes that big businesses should play a prominent role in what he calls the social revolution.
At a simplistic level, if the last century was about, you know, NGOs had great intentions but not always great execution, and business had great execution but not always great intentions, what this century can be about and needs to be about is business having both great intentions and great execution.
Doug Richards, the founder of the School for Startups, which teaches people to be entrepreneurs, says it's especially important to motivate young people and give them the right tools to succeed.
I think the biggest challenge to people starting, young people in particular, starting businesses is that they don't believe they can. I think if you strip away a lot of the noise, it tends to be a case of empowerment. People think other people are successful. People think, I couldn't be that person. somebody who is young and not particularly advantaged will look at somebody who's older and successful and not see how they can get from where they are to being that quite distant foreign person. The challenge that we face and continue to face is making very real for young people, especially those who don't aspire enough, a clarity of path so that they can see what ladders they can climb to climb out of their current position and end up as successful entrepreneurs.
According to co-founder David Jones, the summit is part of a greater process. He urges young people to think about it as a starting point to make the world a better place, and hopes that they will come back with concrete results at next year's One Young World Summit in Johannesburg. For Monocle, in Pittsburgh, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
And you are listening to Midori House. The China Beige Book, or CBB, is a new private survey inspired by the U.S. Federal Reserve's book of the same name. CBB uses hundreds of researchers in every major province in China to assess the economy, from the local sentiments of factory workers to the relative balance of production between different sectors. The survey claims to have uncovered a number of things at odds with traditional surveys. Monocle editor Andrew Tuck talked with the head of the CBB, Leland Miller, to find out more.
Explain to us a little bit about your ambitions with the survey. Is it mainly being used by people looking to invest in China, or is it being used by governments wondering what's happening in that giant economy?
Well, I think it's used by anyone who wants to understand the Chinese economy a little bit better. Obviously, multinational companies investing in China, financial firms, governments would be wise to take a look. But what we've actually done here is take a look underneath the surface, at the various regional economies, at the various sectoral economies. So we think that we've actually cut to the actual dynamics or what's happening on the ground and getting them in virtually real time.
Can I ask you a very simple question? You know, how do you do this? Because, you know, the Chinese, yes, there's a certain openness at several levels, but, you know, they're not that keen on you going knocking on factory doors and asking workers what they really kind of think of the life. Or, you know, how on earth do you manage to pull this together?
Well, we were a little bit concerned at the beginning, and it took us several years to put together to make sure that we were doing things that would not immediately get shut down by the government, that wouldn't annoy the provincial authorities, but at the same time would get us all the information that we need. So we have essentially... we've found over the course of the past several quarters that the Chinese government is actually very interested in getting better information on their economy. We're not a political commentary. We're not a social commentary. We go down into the nitty-gritty of the granular data, and we investigate the trends on the ground, and we stay within the economic realm, and we've been left alone.
So people within the Chinese administration are taking your report, and they're intrigued as well by what you're finding?
We think so.
Good. Now, we just touched there on the story of Apple, and one of the things that has been headline news for a long time is, you know, Apple's problems with its Foxconn factories there in China. Now, what that hints at is working condition problems, which many people worry is spilling over into an increasing number of strikes, that there's a kind of dissatisfaction within Chinese factories because they're seeing their salaries not quite matching their ambitions or what they want to purchase. Is that something you did find in your latest report?
Sure. We find it in some places more than we see it in other places. One of the key components that when we're trying to evaluate labor dynamics from the various regions is how much costs are going up, how much prices are able to move, are prices being eaten into, the profit margins being eaten into, who is moving where, are migrants staying home because salaries are rising instead of moving to the coastal provinces. All of these labor dynamics dictate how various sectors will develop over the coming 3, 6, 12 months. So we look at the inflation component, we look at the labor component, we look at the rise in salaries very closely.
And do you think there is kind of more labor unrest ahead?
Well, I think that if you look at the external factors confronting China, you have worldwide deleveraging, you have trouble in Europe, you have a potential fiscal cliff in the United States. So you have a situation where the Chinese government, which has relied on export growth for many, many years now, understands that it will not be able to do that. And in order to overcome this problem, they're going to have to increase the consumption levels. And that means getting the household sector more affluent and able to spend more on the economy. And I think that this is the dynamic that they're going to be going against if you transfer more money to the household sector instead of the banks who are lending it out and funding infrastructure. Then you have a more rebalancing, but you also have the potential for social unrest. So it's a balancing act, and it's a very difficult one.
When we've been around to see some manufacturers, you have conversations with people where they say, look, we've been making stuff in China, but to be honest, salaries now at the level, we're thinking about moving our production to Bangladesh, or we're thinking about moving it to Vietnam. Is that a genuine trend? And we see reshoring company, US companies reshoring their production. Are you seeing that gaining momentum, do you think, over the coming years?
Sure. We've seen that for a while, and we see that going forward. And that's actually not a bad thing. One of the most important aspects of a healthy rebalancing of the Chinese economy would be to lower the emphasis and the reliance on the manufacturing sector. So the idea that certain low-cost manufacturing, low-margin manufacturing might be moving elsewhere is not inherently a bad sign. It'll cause some social anxiety. But as the economy grows up and it develops and the services sector develops, these are things that a healthy economy should be doing. So just because the manufacturers are moving abroad, it doesn't necessarily mean this is a negative trend.
No, I hinted there in the introduction that you feel that your report does kind of throw up some things which are at odds with the traditional surveys. Could you give us kind of one or two examples of what those things are?
Sure. One of the problems with traditional data sources is that official data is not very reliable. But even if you believe that official data is 100% reliable, businesses and others have a very difficult time understanding on-the-ground dynamics just by looking at a national headline number. What's quarterly GDP? What's quarterly inflation? It's impossible to figure out what's happening in Shanghai versus Chongqing or anywhere else if you're looking at just one national number. So what we do is we peel it back and we divide up the country into regions and every region into eight industries. And we evaluate the dynamics within each of those sectors and within each of those regions. And so we get more granular information. Maybe one region is doing quite well. Maybe one region has much slower growth. And we get into the nuts and bolts that way.
That was the head of China Beige Book, Leland Miller, speaking with Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck. Well, we're going to have some news for you in the next few minutes. But first, I have a song, and it is called Somebody That I Used to Know, and it is by Gautier. And that was Somebody That I Used to Know by the singer from Belgium and Australia, born in Belgium, raised in Australia, Gautier, not his real name. I bet you don't know it, but it is Wally DeBakker, apparently. In the next half hour, we're going to hear how jumping on your bicycle can enlighten you, and we're going to find out how Afghanistan is trying to lure tourists to the country. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Nancy, thank you very much. Opposition activists and Syrian state media have today blamed each other for the killing of at least 25 people in the town of Duma near Damascus. Elsewhere, five people from one family, including a child and a woman, were killed in airstrikes at Marat al-Duman. Israeli leaders have today said that the nation was prepared to take action to end a stream of rockets fired in the south of the country. Palestinian militants have fired dozens of rockets into Israel from Gaza in recent days. In response, the Israeli military has fired back and killed at least four Hamas militants in the past 24 hours. Former Société Générale trader Jérôme Kerviel has been handed a three-year prison sentence for his role in France's biggest rogue trading scandal, which ultimately cost his employer nearly 5 billion euros. Here, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has told the British Parliament today that the BBC has serious questions to answer about how one of its former presenters, the now deceased Jimmy Savile, was able to get away with sexual abuse for so long, adding that he didn't rule out further steps in addition to the inquiries already underway. And Pope Benedict has today named six new cardinals, including two from countries with large Muslim populations. All six are under 80 years old and thus eligible under church law to enter a conclave that will one day choose Benedict's successor. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan Wheatley. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from London with me, Nancy Durham. Well,
cycling can lead to enlightenment, or so a new book tells us. Well, Einstein said, life is like riding a bicycle. To keep your balance, you must keep moving. And Einstein is the inspiration behind Ben Irvine's new book, Einstein and the Art of Mindful Cycling. Hello, Ben Irvine.
Hello.
Interesting title for a book.
Thank you. Yeah.
I wondered if I, and I gather you're an avid cyclist.
I am.
Could you begin, it's radio after all, by using your imagination, and I'll try to use mine, and tell us how cycling can make us mindful?
Of course. Yeah, well, the great thing about cycling is that if you ask a cyclist what it is that they love most about cycling, they'll often talk about the effect that it has on their mind. For instance, they'll say it makes them feel happy or energized or creative or alert or aware, compassionate, inspired. So I wanted to write a book about these effects. And being mindful is about cultivating much more positive sides to human nature into your personality. And we achieve that through reflecting on ourselves and studying which situations bring out the best in us and which don't. And it occurred to me, well, cycling is a really easy way for people to become mindful. Just jumping on a bicycle can make a person feel reflective and calm and have a look at themselves and have some time to think and some time to themselves. And we can all become better people just through the simple act of riding a bike.
So that's connected with that whole movement in, I don't know if I want to use the word therapy, but mindfulness, right? Where you're getting in the moment and you're getting rid of all the clutter and just being chilled out.
That's right. Yeah, I talk about how fostering mindfulness is a bicycle's true métier. So you can obviously use a bicycle to race down the street or to ride in the Tour de France, but I don't think that's the optimal use of a bicycle, strangely enough. I think the optimal use of a bicycle is to make a person feel great while they're riding along and to enhance their day.
Now, I read somewhere that you're a recovered philosopher. So, okay, Einstein, we can also call him a philosopher, a physicist, he's many things. But so I want to ask you about what recovered philosopher means and how that links into bicycling or cycling, and also bring Einstein into the picture too, if you could.
Sure. Well, when I talk about myself being a recovered philosopher, it means that I gradually developed over my many years of study, which included a PhD, an understanding that I needed to be more accepting of the world and my situation in the world. That's what it is to be a human being, is to find yourself as a mind in this wonderful, beautiful universe. And philosophers tend to sort of problematize that relationship and come up with all sorts of ways of creating puzzles and paradoxes out of that simple fact. And mindfulness, of course, is the opposite of this sort of problematization. A person who's mindful fully accepts the situation they're in, comes to terms with it, and manages to find a sort of relaxed state of mind. So mindfulness, to me, sort of stems out of philosophy, but it's almost, if you like, the opposite of philosophy. Now, the reason this connects in with Albert Einstein is that he was obviously a wonderfully successful man who revolutionized his field, but he did this through the sort of personality he had and the way he lived his life. He described himself as only passionately curious with no other special talents. And this idea of being passionately curious is closely related to mindfulness. A mindful person has no concerns which are disrupting their mind or getting them caught and tangled up in. They just accept the situation in front of them and look at it for what it is, and also become more creative through that process. And these sorts of characteristics Einstein had in spades. So because cycling fosters mindfulness, the idea is that cycling can make you more like Albert Einstein.
It's a quite sweet idea. Einstein, I've got a picture right here of him on his bicycle. I think it's in California, not sure, but he's certainly looks very happy pedaling along. Was he really much of a cyclist?
Well, he was, yeah. Funnily enough, even half a century after his death, there's not much information out there about Einstein and cycling. I trawled through the archives, but he did cycle a lot as a young boy. Him and his friends used to go on cycle tours where they would take a scientific approach to the world and analyse everything around them. He also cycled with his first wife, Mileva Maric, and their family. And he also cycled around Princeton when he lived in America after he fled the Nazis. He was perfectly capable of affording a motor car at that time, but he chose to cycle around the town because it was a sort of active resting for him. It inspired him, just like playing his violin inspired him to great feats of imagination.
And you want to see other people get on their bicycles. Your book is also going to tell them where they can go, politely.
Yeah, of course. Well, I live in England, so I run a magazine called Cycle Lifestyle, which is a free magazine which espouses all the virtues of cycling, and you can find out more about that at cyclelifestyle.co.uk. It's one of the very few magazines in the world which actually promotes cycling to non-cyclists, because obviously that's where the growth is, and cyclists already know all about the benefits of cycling, so we're trying to bring those benefits to a wider public. You can also buy signed copies of the book for a limited amount of time on cyclelifestyle.co.uk for anyone who's interested.
The one thing that does cross my mind, if you really do lose yourself in mindfulness and you're on a cycle, it could be rather dangerous.
Yes, I would caveat that very heavily. I don't think it's a case of losing yourself. In a way, it's a heightened self-awareness. But through that heightened self-awareness, you become more aware of what's happening around you. You clear away all the stress and all the anxiety and the thoughts, sensations and feelings that are worrying you, and you have a much more lucid experience of your environment and of your own presence in that environment. So it's actually the perfect state of mind for someone cycling along, rather than, say, being disrupted by an iPod or a mobile phone or what have you.
Well, thank you very much for this. I might just put some air in my tires and have a go when I get home. That was Ben Irvine, author of Einstein and the Art of Mindful Cycling, Achieving Balance in the Modern World. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this with some music and a chat about tourism in Afghanistan.
Join us at midday London time every weekday for The Briefing, Monocle 24's fast-paced hour-long roundup of global breaking news stories, in-studio analysis, and a first look at the North American front pages. And for those waking up on the East Coast, it's the perfect way to get a Monocle take on the stories you need to know at the start of each day. The Briefing, live at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York and 6 a.m. in Chicago.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 Diaries by Marks, and Hakisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas, or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time is now 40 minutes past 1800 here in London anyway. And I have a question for you. Planning a holiday, perhaps somewhere different? Well, Afghanistan wants you. I dare say Afghanistan needs you. They've just opened their first national park in the Bamiyan region, a corner of the country which is rich in archaeology, beautiful scenery, and wildlife too. Monocle contributor Daniela Pellid has come into the studio to chat about this. Hi, Daniela.
Hi.
The idea of going on holiday in Afghanistan is kind of exciting.
Yes, and in a way, I would recommend it, although I wouldn't obviously be giving you any odds for your insurance, which would probably be quite high. But it's a very, very beautiful country with some incredible, incredible sites, rich in history. The people, on the whole, are pretty friendly.
Yeah.
And
given half a chance, right?
Given half a chance. And its recent history, or the last few decades, is very interesting and very sad. But in terms of the countryside, the historical remains, it's fantastic.
And now a national park. I mean, mm-hmm. How much do we know? They've been trying to get this off the ground for a little while, I think.
Yeah, and I think this is a general aim, which is being enacted by Afghan NGOs to try and work on the ecology of the area, because there's a lot of problems with people cutting down trees and bushes for fuel, and so then you get a kind of dust bowl effect. And that's a problem in a few places across Afghanistan, because there's plenty of water in the country, the country is quite fertile. The problem is in conservation and in fuel efficiency as well.
Now, in this particular area, I think it was in the news because are not those famous statues carved into the walls
the Buddhas
blown
of,
up
the Buddhas
by,
of Bamiyan, yeah.
Thanks to the Taliban or whoever did that, are gone, mm-hmm. or some of them. But are there many other wonders that remain there?
Well, even in Bamiyan, it's not a particularly rich province, but it's It's very beautiful. The climate is very lovely. And there's a lot of local, internal, and also some international tourism, well, for internationals in Afghanistan. And, of course, the famous Buddhas were destroyed by the Taliban in 2001. But there are many, many caves which used to be used by the Buddhists back in about 600 AD.
And you could go inside.
Yeah, of course. And there is a series of very beautiful lakes in the province as well. And it's been, as I said, there's been quite a lot of internal tourism there. In recent years, the road to Bamiyan province from Kabul has become increasingly insecure. And that is really the problem with tourism in Afghanistan, is the insecurity and the unpredictability.
You need to jump from the sky or something to get in safely? They must be putting a lot of consideration into how to get people there if they're now opening their door.
Yeah, I mean, really, the safest way to travel from city to city in Afghanistan is to fly, even though the flying in the planes, the internal flights in Afghanistan, I have to say, possibly some of my hairier moments in life. But really, you know, road travel is insecure. It's not just the Taliban. It's the fact that there's crime, there's insecurity, which is really what it says it is. You don't know whether you're going to set out on that journey and arrive safely.
What about where you stay? Are there nice
Yes, in Bamiyan there are some very, very lovely guest houses, some hotels. I heard that there was a very lovely Japanese guest house there a few years ago. I don't know if it's still going. But yeah, I mean, around Afghanistan, I've stayed in some really quite charming hotels, I have to say.
But so it's, who's it for? I mean, would you recommend this to any but the hardiest, courageous traveller?
Well, I think it's really largely for two groups of internationals. Those are the aid workers, of which there are still quite a lot in Afghanistan, looking for a bit of a break from Kabul or one of the other cities, and people who are very, 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 very adventurous and want to climb some mountains or do some extreme fishing or another activity of that ilk.
And the park itself, is it? I know you haven't been right to it, but you've been nearby or roughly in the area. Is it huge, sprawling?
Yeah, I mean, this is an area, a very, very large area with a dozen or more villages within it. So it, rather than a park, which is well maintained, it's more of a sort of a conservation area. And they want to, the NGOs who are enacting this program want to work with the villagers so that they help to preserve the beauty of the surrounding countryside.
Will you be planning a trip there?
I have to say, I would love to go.
I would too. It sounds very exciting.
I would go in a heartbeat.
So will you?
And I'm not being paid by the Afghan tourist.
No, of course not. And you'll send a dispatch to us from there, of
Definitely.
Course.
Definitely. Letter from Bamiyan.
That's excellent. Thanks so much for coming in. Really nice to
My
see
pleasure.
You. Daniela Pellet. You're listening to Midori House with me, Nancy Durham, on Monocle 24, live from London. Well, from Afghanistan to Germany, a country which is well known for its cars and food, among other things, of course, though perhaps music doesn't leap to mind. However, Germany has just become the third biggest music market in the world, recently surpassing the UK. Now, third place leaves it just behind those huge American and Japanese markets. Earlier today, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with German music journalist Christian Ile about the music boom.
Germany sometimes have a bad reputation in terms of music, but it's an incredibly strong market. Are people still going to record shops to buy their albums, or are they buying more online in Germany?
There are more buying online than in earlier years, but I think we're still playing catch up on that kind of downloading business. It's more like in a big market you buy. We don't have such a good record shop culture anyway, so it's more like you go to a supermarket to buy a CD. So that kind of represents the kind of music we got in the charts.
So Germany is more like kind of big chains of supermarkets or record shops, but not really independent, correct?
Yeah, that's true. It's more like what they call in England HMV and stuff like that, or Virgin Megastores, something in that sells the most units in Germany. We don't really have famous record shops, not like Rough Trade in London, but I guess in Berlin and in Hamburg, there are the most well-known jobs, but I couldn't say that's the one that really the heart of German record shops.
And Christian, I heard that actually German artists, they are doing very well in the charts at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. In the last year, from the 15 most selling records, there were 11 by German artists, which I think was never in the last 40 years, I guess, since the Beatles started to bring English music to Germany. We were very much buying American stuff and English stuff, so that's a pretty new thing that so many German acts are selling so much units.
Do they sing in German or in English?
It happens both ways. I guess we have this kind of music that's kind of bad. It's called Schlager music, and that's more German speaking. But we have some acts like they are doing English speaking stuff as well. So, but it's mostly German speaking nowadays.
So, for example, from the 15 most successful albums, how many of them were sang in German?
9 of them were in German. Just two artists who are actually German, but were singing in English. Mostly German acts that are successful are singing in German as well.
Do you think a German artist can do a crossover to a global audience?
I think only if it can appeals to the cliche about Germany. Like I think the last act we had that were a big successful act in the US and in the UK was Rammstein, and Rammstein is pretty much what do you expect from German music. And before that, in the 70s, you had Kraftwerk, which is very much like people probably think we Germans kind of are like cold and more into the electronic stuff. I guess maybe on the smaller, more in the niche markets like electro and techno and minimal, that's probably where Germany is, has good acts that could travel to somewhere else. But that's kind of the markets versus the language doesn't matter anyway.
You mentioned Kraftwerk. I believe it's one of your favorites, correct? Can you tell which one is your favorite song? Because we're going to play a little bit of that song.
Yeah, I really love Das Model by Kraftwerk, which is a German-speaking version, and there's an English-speaking version as well, which is called The Model.
Sie ist ein Model und sie sieht gut aus. Ich nehm sie heute gerne mit zu mir nach Haus. Sie wirkt so kühl an, sie kommt niemand ran. Doch vor der Kamera, da zeigt sie was.
What a wonderful song. I totally agree with you, Christian. I have to ask you as well. I mean, I know a lot of people criticize Schlager or whatever, but I think it's a subject that I'm fascinated about. Can you tell us a little bit about Schlager for those who doesn't know?
Yeah, I probably guess most people know what Eurovision Song Contest, kind of music that gets played there. And I think Schlager is very much the epitome of Eurovision Song Contest. And it was a big thing in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s. And nowadays it got some kind of revitalizing. Since 10 years or so, people are more into Schlager, and they are selling millions of units. When I was talking about the most successful German acts or the most successful acts in Germany, there were 3 or 4 of them that were Schlager stars. That's really one of the most living music markets in Germany.
Well, I have a personal request, actually, about a singer called, correct my German if it's wrong, okay? Dorte, yeah. And the name of the song is Warst du doch in Düsseldorf geblieben? Tell me what it's about. I always listen to this song all the time.
Yeah, it kind of means you should have never left Düsseldorf and stayed with me there. So,
shall we listen a little bit?
Wärst du doch in Düsseldorf geblieben, schöner Playboy. Du wirst nie ein Cowboy sein. Wärst du doch in Düsseldorf geblieben, das wär besser für dich und für Düsseldorf am Rhein.
Who is number one on the charts at the moment?
In the album charts, number one is a German ambient pop project that's called Schiller, like the German writer. And in the single charts, it's Adele with her James Bond song.
Oh, well, she's everywhere, no?
Yeah, but last week it was a German hip-hop act which had its first number one, which kind of shows that German artists are on the up right now.
And a final question. I'm just very curious. I've been reading about an artist, and I believe he's Germany's most successful recording artist. His name's Herbert Grönemeyer. Can you tell us a little bit more about him and how important he is for the music industry in Germany?
Yeah, he's in the game since the 80s. In his early years, he was a part-time actor as well. So he played a part in Das Boot, which is a kind of submarine movie from the Second World War, which is very famous. And then got a recording career, and he's selling records since the 80s. But he really reached another peak in the last five, six years. Yeah, it's like AOR kind of music. It's definitely not Schlager. And I guess he has a pretty good taste in music because he has his own record label, which re-released all these old grout rock acts like Neu. So I guess he has a good taste in music, which doesn't always show in the songs he's releasing, but that's just my personal opinion. But he's very popular. He's probably the biggest solo artist that isn't just commercially successful, but has some kind of critical renommee as well.
Oh, that was fun. Christian Ile, music journalist there, chatting with our very own Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who obviously is into German music, and we can expect more from him on that, I think. And from me, a song called This Is Impossible. Well, it's called Impossible, and it is by Daniel Merriweather. That was Impossible by Daniel Merriweather. And that's all we have time for today. I want to thank our producers, Don Trump and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our studio manager, Ben Jay, and interns Henrietta Landells and Jesse Peacock. After the news, we join Sophie Grove for The Entrepreneurs. We'll find out about yacht making in Cape Town, a British shoe designer launching a new brand, and we'll meet author Grant McCracken, who tells Sophie how entrepreneurs can uncover big business ideas from the smallest pieces of culture.
It's really about how to make a piece of culture that engages people's imagination and interest, and they work brilliantly for marketing purposes. They work well for innovation purposes.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 here in London, Tyler Brulé and Hugo MacDonald will be here for the Monocle Daily. Tyler will also be in the Midori House chair tomorrow at the same time. I'm Nancy Durham. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye.